Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 345 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'm going to be going over some anatomy that's relevant to the USMLE Step 1 exam. I'll be going over a few like cases / vignettes just to illustrate certain key points. And I'll be focusing almost exclusively today on cardiovascular anatomy. So, let's assume, for example, you're trying to perform an intercostal nerve block. And they tell you that, how should the anesthetizing needle be introduced into the person's thoracic cavity? Well, if you see a question like that, the thing I would want you to hopefully remember is that you want to go along the inferior edge of the rib, right? Because again, the MDMEs love to do this play on words when they know that, people will see that something is happening. And when they see something is happening or they've learned something a certain way, if it's put in a different format that is, you know, kind of similar, but just a little bit different, they don't take those unnecessary precautions. So essentially, the thing that's happening here is you're doing a nerve block. So if you're doing a nerve block, you're trying to catch the artery. You're trying to hit the artery, right? So you're going to go along the inferior edge of the rib in those circumstances, right? You're going to go along the inferior edge of the rib. So remember that along the inferior edge of the rib, that's where you have your intercostal bundle of vessels, right? Your intercostal bundle of vessels, you have the intercostal vein, it comes first. And then after that, you have the intercostal artery, it comes just below the intercostal vein. And then after that, you have the intercostal nerve, right? So you're going to get to the nerve third if you're going with a needle in the inferior edge of the rib. Remember, you go to the superior edge of the rib if you're trying to withdraw fluid from around the lungs or whatever, if you're trying to do like a thoracentesis, because if you go above the superior edge of the rib, then you're essentially avoiding that intercostal bundle so that you don't injure them, right? But if you're doing a nerve block, you're trying to hit that bundle. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, they give you like a chest x-ray and they tell you that, this is a chest x-ray that was taken in inspiration. And you notice that the person's diaphragm you notice some asymmetry on the chest x-ray. You notice that, wow, the right diaphragm is very high compared to the left diaphragm, right? So what will the cause be in those circumstances? Well, that the thing is that diaphragm asymmetry where you see like one diaphragm much higher than the other, the thing you should be thinking about on your MDME exams is if the person having some kind of a diaphragmatic paralysis, right? So remember, the diaphragm is innervated by the phrenic nerve, right? C3, 4, and 5. Remember that mnemonic, that C3, 4, 5 keeps the diaphragm alive, right? So the ventral rami, remember there are dorsal rami, there's ventral rami, right? So the ventral rami of the C3, C4, and C5 nerve roots supply the phrenic nerve, right? So if the phrenic nerve has been paralyzed, then the person is going to have diaphragmatic paralysis. Diaphragmatic paralysis. So again, whenever you see, again, these are all just classic things you love to test on the USMLEs. If you see an image, right, and you notice that, wow, one diaphragm is much higher than the other, then you want to think about diaphragm paralysis. You want to think about phrenic nerve damage. You want to think about damage to C3, 4, and 5. And I guess one other quick tidbit I want to mention with regards to the phrenic nerve that, you know, is exam worthy to know for sure, is that the phrenic nerve, remember, it runs anterior to the root of the lung, right? The root of the lung, you know, when it arises from the mediastinum, the phrenic nerve runs anterior to the root of the lung. But the vagus nerve, which is cranial nerve 10, actually runs posterior to the root of the lung, right? Runs posterior to the root of the lung. Now, what if they give you a question about like a 25-year-old male? You know, they tell you that he's coming to the emergency room. His blood pressure is like 60 over 40. So it's very low, obviously, right? And they tell you that, you know, he just got stabbed in the chest on his way home from work, right? And they tell you that you can barely perceive any kinds of heart sounds, right? And then they say, this person's symptoms are most likely due to the nerve, to the knife traversing what, right? And then one classic thing they can do is they can give you many different layers of the heart, right? So they can say, they are having these symptoms because the knife traversed the visceral layer of the pleural cavity. Or let's say they say, traversed the parietal layer of the fibrous pericardium, or traversed the visceral layer of the serous pericardium. They just give you all this play on words, right? Obviously, this person has cardiac tamponade. Remember, in cardiac tamponade, the person essentially has stuff, you know, like blood, for example, in the pericardial space. And because of that, the heart cannot fill with blood, right? Because that fluid is causing an external compression of the heart. If you get that external compression of the heart, that's going to be problematic, right? Because the heart cannot expand to fill with blood, right? So what layer? Because the thing is, if you get stabbed in the chest, it doesn't necessarily mean you have tamponade, right? Because if you don't get to the heart parenchyma itself, then you won't necessarily have any problems, right? But the thing is, this person having cardiac tamponade from like a stab wound, remember, cardiac tamponade has a triad, right? Hypotension, JVD, and muffled heart sounds, right? Again, JVD because your jugular veins cannot drain into the heart because the heart has diastolic dysfunction from being cramped around by fluid, right? So essentially, the thing that has happened here is that the knife has traversed the visceral layer of the serous pericardium, right? The visceral layer of the serous pericardium. Because the thing is, remember, the heart has two pericardial layers around it, right? It has the serous pericardium, and then it has the fibrous pericardium. The serous pericardium is the part that is juxtaposed to the heart itself. The fibrous pericardium is the part that is on the outside of the heart, right? Is more outward compared to the serous pericardium. But don't forget, the serous pericardium has two layers. It has the visceral layer and it has the parietal layer, right? So if you're essentially going from the heart to the outside world, we have the heart, it's encased in the visceral serous pericardium. And then that is further encased in the parietal serous pericardium, and then that is encased in the fibrous pericardium, right? So if, for example, you're going to damage a person's heart from a stab, don't do this obviously, but if a person's heart is damaged from a stab wound, right, you must have traversed the visceral serous pericardium for the person to have those kinds of symptoms, right? And then what if they give you a question about like a newborn? They tell you that, you know, he presents with cyanosis and, you know, he's diagnosed with like tetralogy of Fallot. And then they tell you, oh, what's the most likely cause of his cyanosis, right? And then let's say they give you a few options, right? So let me run through a few options with you here. So let's say one option is they tell you, oh, the reason this newborn is cyanotic is because of blood flow, right? So let me give you the options. Blood flow from the left to the right side of the heart, secondary to increased pulmonary venous pressures. Or I give you another option. I say, oh, blood flow from the right to the left side of the heart, secondary to increased aortic pressures. And then I give you another option that says blood flow from the left to the right side of the heart, secondary to increased pressure in the ductus arteriosus. And then I give you another option that says blood flow from the right to the left side of the heart, secondary to increased pressures in the pulmonary arterial system. But if you think about it, what kind of answer do you want to go with? Well, I really hope you're saying, okay, let me go with the fourth option that Divine gave. Right? Remember, people that have tetralogy of Fallot, right? There's classically four findings. Again, those four findings, they sound like a disparate series of findings, but they are not that disparate. They're actually pretty consistent if you know what you're doing, right? Again, remember, embryologically, the thing that happens, and I'll answer this question in a bit, but let me give some pathophase here to give you some understanding. But embryologically, the thing that happens is that, think of the heart as a box, right? And let's say, you know, you have the right ventricle on one side, the left ventricle on the other side. Whenever you want to divide the ventricles, the thing that happens is you start off first by the muscular interventricular septum growing from the bottom, right? And then your aorticopulmonary septum, right? So look at the name, aorticopulmonary septum. It's a septum that divides the aorta from the pulmonary arteries, right? It's supposed to come down, and part of it, you know, is supposed to sort of kind of form some part of your membranous interventricular septum. And that's supposed to divide the heart into two parts, right? Like the membranous interventricular septum is supposed to, exactly, because it's almost like something is growing from the top and then something is growing from the bottom, and they need to meet in the middle so you can perfectly divide the ventricles, right? So the thing growing from the bottom is the muscular interventricular septum. The thing growing from the top is the membranous interventricular septum. They meet in the middle, right? And then they divide the heart. So if for some bizarre reason, right? Your muscular interventricular septum is growing upwards, but your membranous interventricular septum, you know, through the aorticopulmonary septum, comes down to the right of center. If it doesn't meet the muscular interventricular septum in the middle, it just meets it to the right of center, then you can already begin to see some problems arising, right? First things first, you'll see that since they don't meet in the middle, right, there's going to be an obvious communication between the right and left ventricle. That's going to be a VSD, right? That's one of the findings in tetralogy of Fallot. And then another classic finding, right, is, if you notice, since this aorticopulmonary septum, right, grows to the right of center. The thing that's essentially happening in those circumstances, right? It's growing to the right of center. The thing that's essentially happening in those circumstances is that the right side of your, like, because look at it, aortico-pulmonary septum, septum that divides the aorta from the pulmonary artery, right? If it's growing to the right of center, that means it's more right shifted. So that means it's going to be taking up some of the space that's taken by the normal pulmonary artery. So let's say the normal pulmonary artery width is supposed to be like 2 centimeters. I'm just making up numbers here. But because this membranous interventricular septum, which again is almost like derived from the aortico-pulmonary septum, because it goes off to the right of center, right? The thing that happens is the diameter or the width may be like, 1 centimeter, right? Obviously, that's not enough space for the pulmonary artery, right? So the person is going to have pulmonic stenosis. That's one of the findings, right? So if you notice that a person has pulmonic stenosis, well, obviously the right ventricle is going to have to work harder to pump blood out of the heart. So they're going to have right ventricular hypertrophy. And then, since they have right ventricular hypertrophy, right? Again, that's going to cause pulmonary hypertension, right-sided heart failure, right? But we see that septum, since it's growing to the right of center, the pulmonary artery is getting little space. So that means someone else is going to get that extra space. That's going to be the aorta. That's the overriding aorta, right? So those are the four findings in tetralogy of Fallot, right? Overriding aorta, pulmonic stenosis, right ventricular hypertrophy, and a VSD, right? So because the right side of the heart has much higher pressures than the left side of the heart, blood is going to flow from the right ventricle to the left ventricle. And when it flows in that direction, right, you're obviously sending deoxygenated blood to the rest of the body. So it's going to be some kind of cyanotic shunt. It's going to be a right to left shunt. It's going to be cyanotic, right? So the answer is going to be the fourth option, right? There's the reason this child is cyanotic, right, is because they have blood flow from the right to the left side of the heart, because of increased pressures in the pulmonary arterial system, right? Because, again, they have a pulmonary pulmonic stenosis, right? Pulmonic stenosis. Now, what if they give you a question about a 72-year-old male and they tell you that he comes to the emergency room, he has like severe abdominal pain, and they tell you that, they think that his symptoms are because he has like a small bowel obstruction from an indirect inguinal hernia, right? And then they say, what is the most likely finding on physical exam, right? So let me give you a few options, right? So let's assume one option is, his symptoms are arising because of a bulge that is medial to the femoral artery pulse with a Valsalva maneuver. And then you see another answer that says, a bulge medial to the inferior epigastric pulse with a Valsalva maneuver. Or you see another one that says, arterial pulsations of the inferior epigastric vessels medial to a bulge elicited with a Valsalva maneuver. Or you see another option that says, arterial pulsations of the inferior epigastric vessels lateral to a bulge elicited with the Valsalva maneuver. And then you see another answer that says a bulge lateral to the superior epigastric pulse elicited with a Valsalva maneuver, right? I'm going to read these options again so you can kind of think about it, right? So the first one is a bulge. So this person, we think they have an indirect inguinal hernia, right? So we see the answers: a bulge medial to the femoral artery pulse with a Valsalva maneuver. And another one says a bulge medial to the inferior epigastric pulse with a Valsalva maneuver. Another one says arterial pulsations of the inferior epigastric vessels medial to a bulge elicited with the Valsalva maneuver. Another option says, option D, right? Arterial pulsations of the inferior epigastric vessels lateral to a bulge elicited with a Valsalva maneuver. And then the fifth option says a bulge lateral to the superior epigastric pulse elicited with a Valsalva maneuver. Right, you see all these words. Again, when you see all these words on an in-beam exam, you just freak out, right? So it's like, how do you approach this? Again, many of these questions that have these very confusing answers end up being the easiest ones, right? The first thing you should always do when you're confronted with questions like this is ask yourself, what is the right answer supposed to be? Come up with the answer in your mind first before you start looking at the answer choices that are given, right? So really, the third option I gave is the best, right? Is the best. So if a person has an indirect inguinal hernia, well, think about it. Right. I know this is not exactly, cardio, but this is like vascular anatomy of some sort. So I want to emphasize this here because it's something that people tend to mess up a lot on exams. Right. So this person can be said to have like an indirect inguinal hernia. Well, remember, these indirect inguinal hernias, right, they arise lateral to the inferior epigastric vessels. Right. They arise lateral to the inferior epigastric vessels. Right. So the thing is, you can elicit these hernias by either like palpating a bulge, right, lateral to the inferior epigastric vessels, right, or you can palpate a pulse medial to the bulge, right, from the hernia, right. It's just basically the same, just different ways of stating the same thing, right. We know that these indirect inguinal hernias, they are lateral to the inferior epigastric vessels. So if they are lateral to the inferior epigastric vessels, right, you will palpate the bulge of the hernia lateral to these vessels. But if you're looking at it from the perspective of the bulge of the hernia, you will palpate the inferior epigastric vessel pulse medial to the bulge, right? Again, it's just the exact same thing, right? It's just the exact same thing. It's just the exact same thing in these circumstances, right? So again, the third option I gave, right? Oh, arterial pulsations of the inferior epigastric vessels medial to a bulge elicited with the Valsalva maneuver. That'll be the smart thing to pick in these circumstances, right? Now, what if they tell you that, because again, every now and then, the MBMEs love to give questions where a person is stabbed in a particular part of the thoracic cavity, and they will ask you, oh, what is the structure that is most likely injured, right? So let's say, for example, a person sustains a stab wound to the left intercostal space, right? Lateral to the body of the sternum. Remember, your sternum has multiple parts, right? It has like the manubrium, and then it has the body. The body is like the larger part of the sternum, right? So the thing is, if you sustain a stab wound to the left intercostal space, lateral to the body of the sternum, what chamber of the heart would you most likely hit? Well, the chamber of the heart you most likely hit, right, is the right ventricle, right? But you notice the way I kind of did this play on words. Oh, you know, the left intercostal space, lateral to the sternal body. The MBME knows that people's minds will kind of be all messed up, and they'll say like, maybe it's some left part of the heart that is stabbed. No. Right. Remember, the right ventricle constitutes the anterior part of the heart. So because the right ventricle constitutes the anterior part of the heart, if you stab even the left side of the sternal body, you're going to land on the right ventricle. Right. So the answer to this is going to be right ventricle. Right. It's going to be right ventricle. Right. So now what if they give you a question about a medical student or a physician, you know, trying to perform a thoracentesis, right? They're trying to perform a thoracentesis because they're trying to, you know, draw fluid from a person's pleural cavity, right? And then they say, oh, before you encounter the internal intercostal muscles, right, the internal intercostal muscles, what structure, right? What structure will the person most likely traverse, right? And then let's say you get a bunch of options, right? So let's say you get an option that says, oh, before you hit the internal intercostal muscles, you're going to hit up the parietal pleura. And then let's say another option says, oh, you're going to traverse the external intercostal muscles first. And then let's say another option says you're going to traverse the innermost intercostal muscles. And then let's say another option says you're going to traverse the lung parenchyma. Well, what's going to be the right answer here? Well, I really hope you're saying, oh, divine, it's going to be the external intercostal muscles, right? Again, the layers of skin that you need to traverse to get to certain key structures in the body are generally pretty high yield for the USMLE Step 1 exam, right? So the thing is, let's think about this, right? So if you're introducing a thoracentesis needle into a person, right, to draw fluid, the first thing you're going to encounter is you're going to traverse the skin. We know that. That's pretty obvious. Now, after you traverse the skin, you're going to traverse the superficial fascia. After you traverse the superficial fascia, the next thing you're going to traverse are the external intercostal muscles. After you traverse the external intercostal muscles, you're going to traverse the internal intercostal muscles. After you traverse the internal intercostals, you're going to traverse the innermost intercostal muscles, right? And then after you traverse the innermost intercostal muscles, you're going to traverse the endothoracic fascia, right? You're going to traverse the endothoracic fascia. And then after that, you're going to traverse the parietal pleura, right? And then after that, you're going to get into the pleural cavity. After you get into the pleural cavity, you're obviously going to traverse the visceral pleura. Then after you traverse the visceral pleura, you're going to get to the lung parenchyma itself, right? So I'm just going to reel it off again. Again, you're going to go through skin, then superficial fascia, then external intercostals, then internal intercostals, then innermost intercostals, then the endothoracic fascia, then the parietal pleura. You get to the pleural cavity, and then after that, the visceral pleura, and then the lung parenchyma itself, right? So before you encounter the internal intercostal muscles, you're most likely going to traverse the external intercostal muscles, right? Now, because I want to try to keep this podcast short, so I think maybe let me go ahead and let me stop here. Again, I'll make more anatomy podcasts in the future. So as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, right? Step one, step two, CK, and step three. Preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. And I also have a step two CK, step three, you know, complex level two and three course coming up in November. On November 1st, right, we're going to work on test taking processes. We'll talk about test taking strategies. It's the MBME test taking strategies course. It's from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on November 1st. And then from November 2nd to the 5th, we have a review course. It's going to span over 24 hours. And we cover about 2,000 or more scenarios that cut across the different subjects: peds, surgery, OB-GYN, internal medicine, psych, neuro, multi-system processes and disorders, and also biostatistics, ethics, professionalism, communications, the healthcare systems. We'll work on all those things. So if that's something you're interested in, just shoot me an email, or you need tutoring, you know, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll give you some more information. And then I also help with applications, right? Especially like mock interviews. And again, just reviewing your applications and things like that. I do that through Zoom. And then again, I have a new website I started. It's called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. I'm on that website. Basically, many people have said, oh, Divine, I love the life lessons you put at the end of your podcasts. I really wish, you know, you could make more. So I said, make a new website. It even has a podcast attached to it. If you go on Apple Podcasts and look for Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast, you'll find it. Right now, I'm at 28 episodes. But basically, you know, the podcasts are around like 10 to 15 minutes long. And I talk about some life lesson that is, you know, Bible-based teaching that is relevant to our world today. And then I also have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention US Emily Podcast and Videos. That's where I post the videos that I make. And then in addition to that, you know, have this podcast itself on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Spotify, at least the most recent 150. If you want everything from the very beginning, you need to go on the website, DivineInterventionPodcast.com. That's where I also post the slides for the things I've made. And if you want notes that go with many of the, especially the Step 2 CK, Step 3 content, there are notes for them on my website. And obviously there's a there's like a search feature and things like that that can help you navigate. And really, if you subscribe to the website, DivineInterventionPodcast.com, you'll get an email notification whenever I make a new podcast. So thank you for listening to me. I'll see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.